Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
Hey there everyone, and welcome to the TARDIS Library, now in its own spin-off show. I sort of explained at the end of the Doctor Who show number 9 why I'm doing this, and I guess if you just look at the timings, the Doctor Who show number 9 goes for about an hour and a half. What you're about to hear now will go for about an hour from what I can tell, looking at all the bits and pieces I'll be cobbling together. And that would make a 2.5 hour long podcast, which is something I'm trying to get away from on the Doctor Who show. I want the Doctor Who show to be, you know, an hour to an hour and a half, something people can hear in one longish commute or maybe two smallish commutes on the same day, something like that. So I'm splitting off the TARDIS Library. Some months I don't think it will be an hour or so long. It will be shorter, but that's okay. I think it stands on its own as being quite different to the rest of the Doctor Who show. The Doctor Who show is quite chatty. You know, you have myself and David at the start, you have Bob and Jim, and of course you have the very chatty, on his own, Ian Martin doing the A to Z. So I think this can stand on its own. We'll see how it goes. Tell me if you like it. hello@thedwshow.net or tweet us or whatever you like, and let me know. I want to kick off this episode talking about the new Third Doctor series of comics from our friends at Titan Comics. It's been out for about, oh gosh, week and a half by the time you hear this. It's called The Heralds of Destruction Part 1 and is written by Paul Cornell, a very popular writer with Doctor Who people in general and one of my favourite writers personally. The art is by Christopher Jones and colour is by Hi-Fi. The first thing you notice about this issue is the front cover. It's a wonderfully drawn Pertwee. It is a really, really nice cover. As you'd expect from the first issue of a new series, I think they really go to town, and we'll talk about some of the alternate covers at the end of this review. There's even a comment from Uncle Terence. Yes, Terence Dix gets himself on the cover saying, a handsomely drawn epic, which I think is quite cool. It's really a package that draws you in. If you're a classic era fan, if you like the Pertwee Doctor, I think this is a no-brainer to pick up. All right, turning the page, we always have a what happened last time in the comic, but of course there was no comic last time, so we get told what's been happening in the Doctor's life in terms of the TV series and where this story sort of fits into things in terms of the overall timeline. It reads, after enlisting the help of his former selves to defeat the insane Time Lord Omega, the Third Doctor was rewarded by the Time Lords for his victory with a new dematerialization circuit for the TARDIS and by returning his knowledge of time and space travel to him. His earthbound exile was lifted and his beloved TARDIS ready to set off on all manner of adventures, but can it be long before his adopted planet needs him again? The issue kicks off with Mike Yates and Joe Grant having some tie, which is quite an interesting scene. They're out on a date of sorts, but they get called in by the brig. He calls the restaurant, and they get called in. Something, it seems, is happening out in Bedfordshire. Meanwhile, the Doctor, who the Brigadier is also trying to contact, is off playing chess with someone. He's a diplomat, or they're in a private club of some kind. But he gets the call from the Brigadier. He's cobbled together not a mobile phone, but a piece of electronics that I guess enables the Brigadier to contact him. And he runs out and he jumps in Bessie, and there's a guy on the sidewalk who makes a kind of remark about Bessie, and the Doctor, you know, tells him not to worry and roars off in Bessie, sending this guy sort of flying and showing him that Bessie isn't just some clapped out old banger after all. Anyway, before we continue on with what the Doctor's up to, the chap he's just been playing chess with pulls off a rubber mask and... Of course, who else pulls off rubber masks but the Delgado Master? So this is so Pertwee era at this point in time. It's actually incredible. It feels like you're watching an episode. Anyway, the Doctor arrives in a town called Fairford, and he meets up with Joe and Benton and the Brig. Again, very Pertwee era, very, very early 70s Doctor Who. And we learn the town is deserted, there are aliens running riot. But unfortunately here, it feels like the story just jumps a little. It's all been Pertwee era, you know, cozy slippers. But now it's slightly gone up a gear and doesn't feel quite right. I think it could be the design of the aliens who are coming out of their spaceship. They look quite robotic. I think they're trying to draw them like they might be men in suits, and so that they fit with the era, but they don't quite fit with the era in my head, and the way they're shooting lasers, it just feels like it's suddenly jumped. You know, if you're thinking of a record going around and around, it's just jumped. The needle's just jumped forward a little. It just doesn't feel quite right all of a sudden. Anyway, we move on. One of these robots shoots the Doctor with some sort of ray, some sort of laser, but it isn't enough to kill him. He says, oh, it might kill a human, but it hasn't killed me, but it has wrecked my shirt. There's a line like that, which is quite funny. And suddenly we're sort of starting to get back towards this feeling quite Pertwee era, and particularly when the Brigadier calls in a missile strike to destroy these robots. It's like, yep, okay, we're back in the Pertwee era. Yeah, this feels right. The Doctor even picks up a piece of one of these destroyed robots, and some tentacles come out of it and start choking him. Which, again, if you think of the gurning kind of Pertwee face as he gets choked by things during the TV episodes, you'll know the kind of thing that's being drawn here on these panels, which is quite fun. And again, we're swinging back into the Pertwee era again. Oh, and not only that, but we also come across Osgood. No, not that one. The real Osgood, the original Osgood, who helps the Doctor build a sort of a force field to contain these robots out of an old radio, an old army radio. And while the robots are contained, the Doctor thinks he's missing something, so he jumps into Bessie with Joe, and they go roaring back to unit headquarters to try and, you know, I guess, have a think, try and figure out what might be going on while these robots are contained for the time being. When he gets there, he learns that someone's been let into his workshop, and I guess as readers we think, oh gosh, is it the Master? I mean, we saw the Master at the start of the book. Maybe he's hypnotized one of the unit staffers to let him into the workshop. Is that what's about to happen here? But it's not the Master. The Doctor goes into his workshop and finds... Bum, bum, bum. Maybe I'll leave that as a bit of a surprise. I'll tell you who it is next episode, if you don't actually read the comic. But for those of you who do, if you still want a bit of a surprise... there is quite a big one on the final page of the book. So, what did I think? Look, as a story, you've heard me say all through this that there's so much of it that feels exactly like the Pertwee era. It's like a comfortable pair of slippers. It is, you know, spot on. The only thing that kind of took me out of it was just the design of the robots and the way they were shooting lasers. I guess... because we don't see that sort of thing in the Pertwee era done in quite this sort of way. I guess they would have done it this way if they had have had the budget, but it just, I don't know, there's just something about those few pages that takes me out of it a little before we go back into it feeling very Pertwee era. So on the whole, quite good. Art-wise, not bad at all. You know, I know for some artists drawing things like Bessie might be a bit of a challenge. The Third Doctor comes across well drawn in most of the panels. Joe too does pretty well. There's one or two Joe panels where it's like, who is that? It looks absolutely nothing like her. But on the whole, she's done pretty well. The Brigadier looks great. Mike Yates and Benton are a bit hit and miss. Osgood, of course, looks good, although he can be a bit caricatured with his glasses, of course. Yeah, the art isn't too bad at all. So that just leaves us with the alternate covers. Now, we already discussed cover A, that's the cover of the main issue that I've mentioned at the start. Cover B, meanwhile, is a rare thing. It's a photo cover that actually looks good. You know, Titan love doing photo covers, but often they're just so uninspiring and just so, ugh. I think they're for subscribers. I think if I was a subscriber, I wouldn't be wanting the photo covers, but anyway. But this one is a really nice montage of the I guess you would say, the Pertwee era, with Liz and Joe and Sarah and Sea Devils and Unit and Ice Warriors and, of course, the Doctor in the middle of it all. It's like, this is the Pertwee era, ta-da! You know, which is appropriate for the first issue of the Pertwee era comic that they're doing. Cover C, meanwhile, would be my pick, although I really like the main cover that is the cover you'll probably see the most in the comic book shops. Cover C is a watercolour of Pertwee, and it's done on an all-white background. Even the Doctor Who logo is in white. It's just an outline, and the rest of it's white. And it's very effective, and it's very, very well done. It's a really beautiful cover, actually. Cover D, meanwhile, is a slightly comical portrait of the Third Doctor. At least, I think it's meant to be comical. It certainly looks comical. It's not quite cartoonish, but it's kind of funny looking. Have a look. See what you think. And that's it. In terms of a rating, I'd probably throw about a 7.5 out of 10 at this, maybe even an 8. It is up there with a perfectly competent opening, you know, salvo in a new series. It feels very much like the Pertwee era for 90% of it, 95% of it. And that's all you can really ask, isn't it? You know, there's the Master being set up near the start. He'll come into it somehow. Unit's there, Joe's there, the Doctor's there. And then this big reveal at the end, which will prove to be quite interesting, I think, given that the Master's in this story too, because, well, that would be giving it away if I said much more. So, yeah, the Third Doctor from Titan, issue number 1. It's out now. Check it out if you're into the classic series or indeed are a Third Doctor fan. Alrighty, let's move on.
Hi, this is Matt Barber. I've again been allowed on to talk about the ongoing Ninth Doctor adventures with Titan Comics. You may have heard me on the Starburst Blue Box podcast, where they continue to accidentally let me on to talk about Doctor Who and to patronise other people. So the latest instalment is the second part of a two-part story called The Transformed. So the first part's set in San Francisco, and the Doctor's received a message for help from Mickey Smith, but it appears to be a future Mickey Smith, who's hoping for a different Doctor. Mickey's wife, Martha, has been turned into a gargoyle, and this seems to be an endemic problem with the citizens of San Francisco. And at the end of the last instalment, Rose has gained superpowers, which turns out to be a precursor for this transformation. And so the Doctor and Captain Jack are working with Mickey, trying to keep Mickey apart from Rose to avoid time problems. And they're trying to solve the problem of people turning into gargoyles. It's a really good story. I really like the idea of the transformation. It's got a bit of the mutants in it. The citizens, including Rose, who are given superpowers, clearly see this as a really cool thing, and they sort of connect it with the arrival of the gargoyles and believe that the gargoyles are somehow threatening the people with superpowers and haven't made the connection that it's part of this evolution, which is quite a neat twist. There's a sort of a Marvel feel to the superpowers, so there's lots of images of Rose and other characters flying. And this is enhanced by the fact it's set in San Francisco. So there's a very kind of American city feel to it. Lots of skyscrapers and the Golden Gate Bridge. So the landscape and the iconography of San Francisco is used very well. Probably slightly better than it was in the TV movie, which is Vancouver by way of San Francisco. I also like the way that it's divided between the two stories. So you've got the Ninth Doctor and Mickey, a very badass Mickey with full goatee that we've seen. So this is after the end of time, and he and the Doctor follow this wormhole to the other side to try and find out who's creating it, because this wormhole is linked with the gargoyle transformations. And so half the story is set in this kind of Marvel universe San Francisco of very grounded skyscrapers, and the other half is set at the other end of this wormhole. And it's a classic end of the world sort of melange of weird aliens and strange, well, on television they'd be costumes. So they discovered that a strange squid-like alien, a kind of a wide boy called Glom, I think, has been engineering this wormhole. It's quite a short, punchy story. So the conclusion is basically plugging up the wormhole, closing it up, and then the transformations reverse. I think for a two-parter, that's probably as effective a conclusion as you can get. Bit sad not to see much of Martha in this, and actually her sidelining as a character and the lack of dialogue is kind of endemic of her appearance on the television. She's very much the companion that's placed to one side, I think, and people like Mickey and Rose and Captain Jack are given a higher priority. Even in Torchwood, Martha was sort of shunted to one side. She was tried out in Torchwood and then seemed to be shunted to one side. And I think that that either carries on in this story, or it's reflective of that. And hopefully we'll see a bit more of Martha as the series progresses. The other thing I really liked, the story ended openly with one of the gargoyles slipping out of the wormhole into a different time. It's difficult to talk too much without giving away the big twist at the end. But suffice to say, for a fan of the classic series as well as the new series, it's a very satisfying link up with quite a satisfying time of the series. And so I'm really looking forward to the next story, or a continuation of this story, or a bit of both, because I'd quite like to see Christopher Eccleston's Doctor in that situation, in that particular situation. Because again, I'm trying not to give away spoilers here, but the time period that the gargoyles slip to is a very stylistically particular period of the show's history, and it's very well matched with the Doctor at that time. And I'm always quite interested to think about what other Doctors would do within that setting. So we'll get to find out in the next story. So overall, I really liked it. I liked the setting. Again, the characters were perfectly drawn. Rose in particular felt very much like Rose, and the relationship between Rose and the Ninth Doctor is a very distinctive one, particularly distinctive as we know so much about her relationship with the Tenth Doctor. With the Ninth Doctor, there's a very particular matchup. And also Captain Jack in this one is stronger than the previous story, I think. He spends a lot more time with the Ninth Doctor and again gets his own identity. And there's still that question of a story arc going on behind the scenes. So overall, it was great, and I'm looking forward to the next story.
Well, g'day everyone. If you're a long-time listener to the show, you'll know that it's quite monumental for me to sit here and say, at long last, I've finished Gary Russell's Big Bang Generation. Thank you. In doing so, a few things actually fell into place. Let me run through them real quick. First, when I got to the end of the book, there's a postscript where Gary explains how he wanted to actually have River Song in the book, but Stephen Moffat vetoed that. Gosh, it's not like Stephen Moffat to veto anything. I mean, just ask John Barrowman. However, I'm just kidding on that, by the way. However, Moffat suggested that he should use Benny Summerfield instead. She's another intergalactic archaeologist, of course. So he did. And that explains Benny in the book. Second, Gary goes on to explain how Benny's gang in this book are from a series of Big Finish audios. I've never actually listened to these, so that explains why this gang was so new to me, and in the process so discombobulating as well, especially her half-dog son, Peter. I mean, what the? Although I believe he might have started off in a Big Finish Benny novel, if that makes sense. Big Finish do novels as well, apparently. I've not read any of those, so I'm all at sea on this topic. Regardless, I guess there's a sense that the characters in this book would have been like a return home and a meeting up with old friends, or putting on of old comfortable slippers for many readers, and maybe they were, but for me, it was just, huh? And I guess it wasn't just the gang around Benny, there were a bunch of other characters in the book besides the Doctor. So, in a tale which, in the end, can be boiled down to there's an archaeological find that transports people to the past, wreaks havoc, and the Doctor has to confront the oldest beings in the universe to put it right, you know, typical Doctor Who stuff, it becomes a much more convoluted tale where a few main characters all need backstories and motivation and something to do in the here and now, and I think the story just bogs down on that sometimes. Well, at least in my mind. I wanted the story to move along without thinking about a cast of thousands and what they're doing and why they're doing it, and, you know, trying to hold on to all these different strands of plot. It just didn't work for me. And, you know, to be fair, the more I read, the more I actually felt comfortable with it. You know, it might not seem that way from the sort of semi-review I did in the last episode, but easily the first 50 pages, if not the first 100 pages, are so packed full of these characters, and they're so timey-wimey to boot, It's sort of like Moffat Light, actually. It's almost like Gary Russell is trying to write a story like a Stephen Moffat TV episode, now that I look back on it, that I just didn't feel inspired to read on. You know, we had all these episodes of the Doctor Who show where I still hadn't finished the book, and last episode I'd made a bit more headway, and now in this episode I've finished it. I guess I felt annoyed at times that the book seemed to be so deliberately obfuscating things, as if that would be enjoyable to the reader. And again, maybe to some readers it is, but to me it isn't. And that's why I struggled to pick up this book and finish it for so long. However, after last episode's update, where I truly felt a little mean for the things I said, I made a conscious effort to just read, read, read. You know, just do it, just get through it, Rob. And after about the first 120 pages or so, the book actually starts to settle down into more of a straightforward sort of story. Easier to follow. There are, you know, some interesting action scenes, and the timey-wiminess even becomes easier to follow, and it all sort of flows from there. So, trust me, it did actually become a better book than the one I was talking about in the last episode. It just took a bloody long time to get there. Again, probably, yeah, about 120 pages in before I started to feel that things had turned, and I was maybe not enjoying it, but being able to cope with it, perhaps. Even that sounds harsh. I don't mean to be harsh. Anyway, does this mean I've changed my mind about the book? I guess partly yes and partly no. I still don't overly like it. However, the second half was more enjoyable to read, and I have to be fair and acknowledge that. Last time I said this book wasn't as good as Royal Blood, one of the other three Glamour Chronicles books, but now I'd say they're probably on par. They're quite different to each other, don't get me wrong on that. And still two books I couldn't really get into, and two books I will never read again in my life. The Big Bang Generation is definitely better than the last few times I've mentioned it on the podcast have perhaps suggested. One thing I'll add as an aside too, now that I come to mention the Glamour Chronicles, is I think trying to thread this theme of the glamour through these three books that came out late last year was a mistake. It seems tacked on into all the plots of all the books, and I have read the third book now, so I can say that quite confidently. I think trying to give a season a theme, whether it's The Key to Time on television or Trial of a Time Lord, or threading it through some books like this, doesn't tend to work. Even when you've got authors who may have even been talking to each other, I don't know how the collaboration was done on these three books. There's not really a lot in common to do with the glamour between them all. It's a bit of a failure, in my eyes, that glamour theme. And I still can't quite get over the name, The Glamour. Anyway, finally, you might also remember the last time I talked about this book, how I pointed out the way it absolutely revels in name-checking tons and tons of places here in New South Wales, particularly around Sydney, which is where I live. I even did a parody of the sort of thing if it was done in a UK context, and how no one would write a UK-based Doctor Who book with the same level of detail and name-checking going on. Well, that continues throughout the book, I'm sorry to say, and it made me wince a lot, because as I explained last time, I have this funny feeling whenever I read books that are set in Sydney, it just doesn't seem quite real to me. I'd much rather my books are set in faraway places. It's just a quirk of mine. But at the end of the book, in that postscript I mentioned earlier, I got the vibe that Gary might actually live here now, here in Australia. I did a little internet research, and it seems that's actually the case. He's working for Planet 55 Studios, just up on the north coast of New South Wales, and helping to make an animated series for the ABC, which is our version of the BBC. In that light, I can sort of see where this, you know, devotion to New South Wales and Sydney might have came from. It wasn't just a holiday. He's actually living here now and obviously wanted to write about this new environment in the story. But to me, it's still over-egged. It might not seem that way for someone overseas. Indeed, it might seem quite fun to see all these new names and dream about all these places you've never been to. But to a local like myself, it just felt a bit cringy at times, especially all those bits in Darling Harbour where I said last time it's basically a tourist trap. So it's quite hard to imagine Capaldi acting seriously with that sort of touristy, tourist trap sort of place as a background. Ugh. Anyway, I could go on, but there you have it. Big Bang Generation gets better. I'm happy to say it does get easier to read the further you go, and the plot starts to make more sense, and it does tie together in the end, but it's still not a great book to my mind. It has enough Sydney references to make me run for the hills, or should I say the Blue Mountains, which also gets quite a flogging in the storyline later in the book. But it doesn't quite deserve the ire of last month's review, or the length of time it took me to finish it. It's better than that, but it's no masterpiece either. So, sorry Gary, maybe next time.
Hello. Is that the time already? More Doctor Who comic reviews, you say? Well, why not? Let's jump right in with a look at the 12th Doctor 2.8. It's the final part of The Twist by George Mann and Mariano Lacastro. Maybe this time I've pronounced his name correctly. So what do we find beneath the three covers we have to choose from this month? If you recall, we left the Doctor, bass player Hattie, and Jakob, the guy with the cybernetic eye, at the mercy of the Foxkin. These bipedal vulpines are the intelligent descendants of the original creatures from the colony ship that founded the Twist. But they have been keeping a massive secret about the origins of the human inhabitants, one they can't let anyone reveal. To protect everything, the Doctor and his companions are condemned to a life of permanent imprisonment in the Foxkin City. And that's where we pick things up. Jakob certainly doesn't like being locked up. He reveals himself to be a nasty, bigoted piece of work, unable to believe that such a vermin had anything to do with his birth. It's perhaps a slightly sudden character development, but it does give a Doctor the opportunity to deliver a great sarcastic put-down. The racist idiot does prove useful, though, as his bionic eye finally makes an appearance in the plot and allows the three to escape. I won't reveal exactly how. Suddenly they're surrounded by more Foxkin, but these are a different bunch. An offshoot would believe that they should reveal themselves and integrate with the human population. Leading everyone back to the park on the surface, they arrive just in time to see the particular Foxkin Hattie hit with her beloved bass guitar being bundled away by the security forces. Armed police and reporters are everywhere, and the Twist's own Nigel Farage delivers a speech about the aliens coming to take our jobs. It's the vindication Jakob's been waiting for. He goes into full-on rant mode, practically frothing at the mouth about destroying the Foxkin. Of course the Doctor knows the truth. He's always known the truth. Jakob's the real monster here, and his complete story has been a pack of lies. The truth's divulged, from Jakob's own eye no less, and he runs off into the crowds. I had a hunch something was up with him from the start. The xenophobic nutter knew his way around those underground tunnels a bit too well. So what's the Doctor's solution to how to reveal the Foxkin to the world? Hold an outdoor rock concert, apparently. Yes, the Doctor gets to play his funky alien guitar with Hattie's band Space Pirates, as their fans, who are all apparently political revolutionaries, gather in the park. Transmitting his message of tolerance to the citizens of the Twist, the Time Lord urges them to never be cruel or cowardly. The power of rock music unites everyone, and both sides greet each other in friendship as the Foxkin step out of the shadows. All this, and Jakob gets arrested. No, I'm sorry, it's utter rubbish. It's the worst kind of saccharine ending, up there with Love Saves You from Becoming a Cyberman, and Thinking Hard About the Doctor Stops Him Being Dobby the House Elf. Is this the best that George Mann could come up with? All that build up over the last few issues, and it's all over because the Doctor tells them to be nice to each other? As if that's what would really happen if you confronted a human population with the truth that they only exist thanks to some super intelligent foxes. Maybe he was trying for a similar feel to the Zygon two-parter from Season 9. And perhaps you could wave it away by saying the future's a more enlightened time and everyone's more loving and tolerant. But that's not borne out by the behaviour shown on the page, when Jakob and his pals are promoting racial hatred. You know what I'd like to have seen? Things go wrong. Give the Doctor his Live Aid moment. Reveal the Foxkin. But have the Doctor misjudge things for once. Instead of peace and love, you get mass panic and fighting on the streets and mutual mistrust. Have the Doctor struggling to find a cleverer way to broker peace and convince the two populations that they won't kill each other as soon as his back is turned. He's a Time Lord. He's got lots of time. Make him work for things and have to stay for 6 months and really put some effort in, not swan off after 5 minutes. No wonder a shielder had to clean up after him. Anyway, let's take it that I wasn't fond of the conclusion to the storyline. We do get a new companion, though, as Hattie joins the TARDIS, for now. She's a bit of a personality vacuum at the moment, so let's see if future issues flesh out her background a bit more. I just hope it's not going to be a constant stream of Spot the Musical Illusion from now on. I've not really mentioned the art so far. It's solid, quality figure work from Mariano and his Argentinian assistants, building on the previous issues, and the Fox King probably looked their best this time out. There's a few double splash pages for the big scenes, but generally I thought there was a distinct lack of backgrounds in most of the panels. Admittedly, there were a lot of talking headshots and close-ups, but it wouldn't have hurt to put in a few lines to give location context. Carlos Cabrera does his best, but just seems to colour everything a bit, well, orange. Mariano seems to be best in the wide angles and multiple points of view. Next time, give him plenty of alien vistas to draw, along with the talking heads. Talking of crowd scenes, though, there's one image as we flip through multiple locations around the twist that caught my eye. Amongst a scene of punk rockers giving it their all is an eerie hooded figure all in white. Like a version of Moon Knight that stepped into Doctor Who, or those headless monks from Matt Smith's tenure. It's very out of place and has to be deliberate. I'll keep a lookout for other appearances of hooded guy in upcoming comics, and hopefully it'll all mean something down the line. All told, despite the artist's best efforts, it's a supremely disappointing end to this story. I had my fingers crossed last month that George Mann could pull things together into interesting shapes, but sadly he didn't deliver. Next issue is still around as writer, but Rachel Stott's back on art. I'm looking forward to that, if nothing else. Still no Fourth Doctor issue 5 at the time of recording, but I believe it's due imminently, so I'll come back to that next time. Instead, I thought we'd take a quick skim through the issues released so far in this year's event series, Supremacy of the Cybermen. 4 Doctors, 6 Companions, a bevy of guest star friends and foes, and a silver implacable army. Sounds like a recipe for a lot of fun, doesn't it? It's written by George Mann. Yes, him again, which doesn't fill me with confidence from the start, but we'll see. This time, however, he's joined by co-writer Kevin Scott. Artist from Alessandro Vitti with Ivan Rodriguez and Walter Giovanni, except for works by Tazio Bettin on a few pages, and the colourist is Nicola Righi. Parts 1 to 3 are out so far, but I'm not going to do my usual blow-by-blow in-depth analysis of each issue. Instead, this will be a few random thoughts about what I've seen so far and how it's shaping up. I'd like to do more thorough reviews, but I think I'll save those for my blog, Ravings from the Rubber Room, available through all good search engines. The first thing to mention is that although we have 4 Doctors featured in this every issue, incarnations 9 through to 12, none of them meet each other. I guess that might come later, but right now each Doctor's in their own timeline with their own problems to face, all caused by the Cybermen. 9's on Earth in 2006 with Rose, Jack and Jackie Tyler. 10 is with Comet's companions Gabby and Cindy in the 24th century. And 11 is with Alice in the time of the dinosaurs. 12, meanwhile, is on his own, after the end of Hellbent. And in fact, Mann and Scott are picking up on plot threads directly from the last 2 episodes of that season. They even deal with a little niggle that some fans had about the appearance of a certain sisterhood. It's a bold move, especially if Moffat's about to do his own spin on these outstanding points next year. Still, if you're going to write an event series, you have to think big. And that's one thing you have to commend this storyline for. It's certainly epic. The Cybermen are more powerful than ever. Time's being rewritten. The Doctors are fighting for survival on multiple fronts, and an old foe's out for revenge. It's my old thing about wanting comics to be more than just normal stories with attractive drawings. You're probably bored about hearing it by now. But this is the kind of thing I wanted. Okay, it's not innovative in the way that the story from a couple of months ago about living people trapped in comics was, but there's no way that this tale could be told on our TV screens, even with a very generous budget. Both writers are obviously having fun here, cherry-picking bits and pieces from the last 6 decades of the series, and expanding things in new directions in some cases. We get a Sontaran leader with a grey beard, the return of a giant creature not seen since Christmas 2008, and even a location from the 5 Doctors makes an appearance. And you can tell from one especially nice page in issue 3, this is truly a story that affects all of the Doctors throughout time and space. In fact, this story has actually surprised me, because I generally don't know where it's heading. I'm a little dubious about turning one character into such an out-and-out bad guy, and there seems to be a lot to deal with only 2 issues remaining, but please, come on George, don't let me down. Not again. So what about the art? Well, Alessandro Vitti's not the greatest at likenesses of the actors, with Dr. Ten and Jackie Tyler coming off the worst, but you can tell who's who. He's far better at the big images like a Sontaran Imperial flagship, or dozens of cyber vessels crowding the sky, or a rampaging dinosaur. It's certainly full of life, backgrounds teeming with detail, almost frantic in places, and his pen was struggling to keep up with the action. The double page where we first meet the Ninth Doctor with its multiple vertical panels and quick cuts is particularly worthy of praise. Plus, who doesn't want to see a giant Cyberman hid in space? As for the work by Nicola Righi, it's certainly very colourful, even lurid at times. Dago plink and deep red backgrounds cast multicoloured shadows on characters' faces. Prehistoric Earth's verdant green and a cyber conversion chamber glows with an eerie light. I really liked it a lot. So, 3 issues down, 2 to go. Maybe time for a little more direct menace from our silver big bads and a couple more twists. But so far, Supremacy of the Cybermen's immensely enjoyable. Right, that's me done for another month. As my favourite Alien Comics editor likes to say, Splundig Verthrig Earthlets.
If you've followed the saga of my reading of the new series adventure Glamour Chronicles mini-series, I guess you could call it, made up of Royal Blood, Big Bang Generation and Deep Time, all starring the Peter Capaldi Doctor and Clara as the companion in at least 2 of the adventures, you'll know that I actually read them slightly out of order. I started reading this novel, Deep Time, second rather than third, and then realizing my mistake, I quickly stopped reading it, even though I was loving it, and went into a multi-month struggle thereafter to try and get through Big Bang Generation, the second novel, a novel which I just didn't like at all, before I could go back to reading this novel, Deep Time, which I knew I really was enjoying and would really like. But you've heard all of that story in multiple episodes, and indeed, even earlier in this episode, I was talking about Big Bang Generation now that I've finally finished it. So let's stop there for the moment and say that Deep Time, this novel by Trevor Baxendale, is a completely different kettle of fish. Both times I've read this book, both the aborted first time and the second time, it felt very comfortable, very Doctor Who from the start, and I always, always, always wanted to be reading more. It's a real page-turner. The premise is that there's an exceedingly rich man who has commissioned a totally kick-ass spaceship and a team of experts to go and find what happened to an ancient race that died out, a race called the Pharaon. And the Doctor and Clara are tagging along for the ride. The story straddles the line quite easily, I think, between being an episode of New Who. It even has a scene near the front that's almost like the pre-credits teaser, which ends on a, you know, dramatic note, and then you can imagine the credits starting and all of that. So it's very New Who in that respect. But there's also a whiff of the classic era about it too, although given the special effects that this kind of story would require, I don't think they would have really pulled it off in the olden days. But straddling that line between classic and New Who, I think, is a really good place to be for any novel, because then it just feels Doctor Who, you know, to everyone reading it. I guess it's interesting that I started talking about the Big Bang Generation earlier, because the books share some similarities in some ways. There's a diverse team of people at work, and they all have their motivations. There's some definite timey-wiminess going on, and of course, there's this theme of the glamour woven into the background of both stories. So why does Deep Time succeed where Big Bang Generation didn't for me? I think, in terms of the characters in Deep Time, they're introduced easily, almost like a whodunit novel where we meet all the people staying over at the manor house for the weekend, you know, at the very start. We're introduced to everyone in the crew of this spaceship very early on. And unlike Big Bang Generation, these people aren't in teams as such. I mean, I guess they're one big team. But individually, I guess some are in pairs, such as the pilot and his astrogator. And the concept of his astrogator and the way she's used is a very interesting concept in itself, which I won't spoil for you here. And I guess the two from the engine room are a bit of a team. But they aren't in small gangs of people like Benny Summerfield and her son and their friends, you know, tossing witty and smug asides to each other like they were in Big Bang Generation. I also like that the timey-wiminess doesn't start straight away in this novel. In Big Bang Generation, it's on like Donkey Kong from the outset, you know, and maybe some people like their story all over the place and fractured and weird and delight in trying to understand it. But me, unless I'm really in the mood, I feel stories like that tend to be quite annoying. It feels like the author is deliberately rubbing their hands together, you know, like, and chuckling because, you know, they know what's going on, but they're feeding it to you in a totally mixed up order with a few red herrings thrown in to boot. And that might entertain them, and again, it might delight some readers, but not me. That's not really my kind of thing. So in Deep Time, we get to know everyone straight off, and we get to decide who we like and who we don't like. And by the time the timey-wimey stuff happens, it's very understandable and makes the plot exciting and not like you want to throw the book out of the window because you don't know what's happening from, you know, the outset. I haven't even mentioned that there's a slight horror element to the book as well either. There are some really rough scenes and some rough stuff that happens to the characters, and no spoilers, but not all of them make it, you know. Several of the crew do get killed off in quite uncompromising ways that feel quite realistic in their depiction. It's absolutely the best book of the three for making you actually care whether members of the crew make it through or not. I mentioned earlier, you get this chance at first to sort of meet the crew and decide, oh, he's a bad egg. Oh, she's kind of interesting. You know, will I like her later on? Oh, I really like her, you know, and as the book goes on, you think, oh my God, I hope this person makes it, I hope they make it, and not all of them do. And, you know, that kind of feeling in a book of this kind, like a TV tie-in kind of book, it's really rare to get that sense of caring for anyone besides perhaps the Doctor and his companion, who you know are going to survive because they have to survive. Often the people in the background, the people on ships or the people manning space stations or whatever it might be, they're just there to move the plot along, and if they get killed, it's like, oh, they got killed. Okay. Here, I actually really did care about these characters, and that's really, really cool in a book like this. I did mention in my Big Bang Generation piece earlier in the show that I think the Glamour Chronicles theme was a bit of a mistake, and that does apply to this book too. All three of the books could have easily stood on their own, and indeed probably did stand on their own, at least as, you know, story ideas, before, I presume, the Rangers editor said, look, we need this theme of the glamour woven in. I could be wrong on that. Maybe some or all of these books were written once they knew they had to write about the glamour, but I'd like to think you could take the glamour out of this and it would still stand on its own, which makes me think that maybe the idea did exist before the glamour came along. To me, the whole glamour thing is just unnecessary. It doesn't really add anything to any of the stories or is something I really wanted to think too much about or worry about. It's just there in the background whilst other stories and things are happening instead that are perhaps more interesting. Even in Royal Blood and Big Bang Generation, there were far more interesting things happening than exactly what the glamour was or how it was manipulating people or who was looking for it or whatever. I'm kind of glad it's just a concept that presumably was in these three novels and never again. Indeed, with no new series adventures planned for this year, I wonder whether this is even the end of the new series adventures as a whole. But that's another story. So, look, yeah, finishing up and trying to keep this as spoiler-free as possible, you'll notice I've not even touched on who or what the Pharaon are or were or what the timey-wimey nature of the book was even all about. Deep Time is undoubtedly the pick of the Glamour Chronicles books. If you wanted to read a Capaldi-era NSA and hadn't already read the original trio books that came out the year before this, this is the pick of 2015's releases, and you don't need to have read the other two to really understand this one. Genuinely, Trevor Baxendale, take a bow. This is a great book, a great page-turner, a great story, and I had a lot of fun reading it. Do check it out if you get the chance.
Hello, it's Lex. I'm here to do the review I do when I do things on this podcast. I am reviewing issue 2.12 of the 11th Doctor comic, and this time the writer is Rob Williams. The artist is I.N.J. Culbard. The colorist is Marcio Menes. Letterer is Richard Starkings and Comicraft's Jimmy Betancourt. And that's it. That's the people we have to thank for this lovely issue. Yeah, this lovely issue that has given me this massive headache. And what I'd like to do here is not give you a headache. So I've decided to create a list. Two lists, actually. Three things I like and three things I didn't like, keeping it nice and simple. Because if I don't do that, I'm going to find myself in a tangle of very detailed lists of how things were so illogically constructed, and I don't want to do that. You don't want a headache, and I don't want another headache on top of this headache. Nobody wants these headaches. So I'm keeping things simple. I'm creating the list of likes right now. Okay, number one, I liked the introduction that they have visually speaking, not so much the words. It's, it was cleverly constructed. It's a transition that takes us from this very timeless, trippy sort of dimension, I guess you could say. And it's timeless. All the tenses are mixed up, and that's cool. And Alice is in some kind of a trance while talking with the master, and takes us from that dimension into reality amongst war and explosions instantaneously with the blink of an eye. And it's jolting, but it somehow works because of the visuals. One minute she's in this dimension and the next she's in reality. And the thing that joins it together is just Alice, and her expression never changes. And the conversation she's having with the master goes uninterrupted. So it's a convincing transition and visually appealing. It makes sense, and it's exciting because of how jolting it is to be taken, you know, from a dimension that's really trippy and timeless into reality very suddenly. I don't know. It's just, it worked. I liked that. The introduction was good. The hook was good. And number two, I like the War Doctor. They've been really consistent with keeping his character on track and matching John Hurt. He's elegant. He's what, badass. He's curmudgeon-y. Is that a word? He's mustached. Okay, he's not just mustached. He's bearded. He looks good. He looks like John Hurt. And final characteristic I like, he's a tortured soul. He still clearly cares about saving people despite being the War Doctor and causing destruction with those big guns he likes to carry around. That's my number two. Number three, I liked... What is my number three? Oh, yes, this is a big one that's critical to the plot line of this issue, which, by the way, is the final explanation of... the final reveal, I should say, of who created the genocide. And spoiler alert... it's not the Doctor. And I can say that because this issue has been out for a month now. If you haven't read it yet, you're never going to read it. Or I'm totally allowed to say this. It's not the Doctor. It's Alice. It's her. It's all her. It's all her fault. She's the one who kills the gods of the Overcast people. And she does it with this instrument of death, I should say, which is my number three of the thing I liked. Things I liked. This instrument of death is called, and this is why I like it, the Silent Music Box. Where do I begin? Listing off the puns and double meanings inside this title of this Doctor Who artifact. It's, well, first of all, an oxymoron. Silent Music Box. They get props for that. It is an instrument of death. And literally an instrument. It creates music. And the word silent is spelt P-S-I-L-E-N-T. The P is silent. Damn it. That's just too much. But no, it doesn't end there. It's psychic. So that's why they're allowed to spell it P-S. Get it? I mean, if you're not saying wow by this point, then there is something wrong with you. And you can stop listening now. That's my number three. Just the irritating brilliance of that construction that this comic came up with. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. Oh, I should explain what it is, though. That's important. This silent music box is, as described by the Doctor, a weapon of mass destruction, yes. And as it turns out, it kills the person who uses it. But more interestingly, it was originally a children's toy. Leave it to the Time Lords to create a weapon of mass destruction out of a child's toy. So it's able to create sort of an all-powerful force, maybe? It's not really clear. I don't actually understand it. It's, as the doctor describes, it joins a subconscious collective thought of a certain people, and it doesn't really say how it determines who is a people and who isn't a people. But yeah, it creates a collective subconscious mind thing psychically, and I guess that's how they're going to, deicide. They're going to commit deicide via ascension through the silent music box. The music box enables a certain group of people to be ascended psychically, and that's how they're going to fight these gods. I guess it's the game plan. And then, of course, the person who does it has to die. Why? I will never know. Because this is a Titan comic and written by Rob Williams. I guess I shouldn't blame it all on him. But it's just so cliche. Why do they have to be so cliche? But yeah, the person who uses it dies, and Alice decides she's not going to let the doctor do this. She acts very irrationally and steals it from the doctor and saves him, sacrifices herself. Not the first time Alice dies in these comics. I'm sure she's going to be fine. I guess that explains it, right? I can move on to my list of things I don't like now. And yeah, number one of what I don't like, the overdramatic philosophic stuff they try to cram into the storyline and dialogue. It's just nauseating and doesn't make sense. And to give an example, the master is talking with Alice at the beginning, like I said, and he says this one thing. In order to murder gods, we had to kill all that is good and heroic. We had to kill belief in our own god. And he's just equating killing all that is good and heroic with killing a belief in their own god, but also killing gods. And it's just, they're not even planning to kill all that is good and heroic. That doesn't fit in anywhere. They're just, that's not what the music box does. They were going to join a collective mind, I thought. Does that kill people? And what else did he say? I'm sorry, I said I wasn't going to get into the minutiae of things, right? Like, that's why I'm doing these lists, so I don't go into tangents. But it's just lines like these that are so overdramatic and philosophic in ways that aren't actually based on accurate applications of, you know, assessment of what is actually happening, what people are doing, what people are thinking. They don't match up. And it drives me nuts. Number two, the master in this issue is so misleading. The way that they have created him is so misleading. He's always going around to his own little corner and muttering things to himself. It's very surreptitiously. Like, at one point, a bunch of, like, a fleet of Gallifreyan bodyguards fly into the atmosphere of the planet, and it's not exactly a good moment, and the doctor's like, oh no, go home, stop, they must turn around, they don't have a chance. And the master will do stuff like, in this situation, mirroring the doctor, saying, yes, they don't have a chance, or yes, they should be stopped, but meaning it in the complete opposite way that the doctor meant it. The doctor means for them to turn around and be like, okay, to live through it, to survive, and the master is implying that they must be stopped and killed. And as he does this, he actually, to add on to the suspiciousness of it all, he has some kind of button, and it's not clear because it's hidden, but he definitely has something in his hand, and he's pressing it, I guess. And he, as I said, he mutters to himself, mirroring the doctor, saying, yes, they must be stopped. He presses some kind of button, and in the next picture, the slide next to it, we see a picture of one of the gods with his hand stretched out and some kind of force coming out of it, and the entire fleet of Gallifreyan bodyguards just explodes. They're destroyed, implying that the master is the cause of it somehow by pressing this button. And it's very misleading because they've put a lot of effort into trying to convince us that it wasn't the master after all that caused this genocide. It wasn't the master that's behind everything. It's the Valitek's cabal, the Daleks, right? It's not the master. They've tried so hard to explain and relieve him of guilt. And even at the end of this issue, they have him muttering to himself again, that he wishes he could have fought with the doctor. He says those words as he selfishly and cowardly escapes to his own TARDIS. But yeah, he says he wants to have fought with the Doctor and he feels bad about it, which is just makes no sense when we had just seen him muttering to himself about killing Gallifreyan bodyguards or wanting them to be dead or pressing buttons. It's just, why are the writers doing this? It's, I feel like they're just misleading us and neglecting their own duty of creating convincing characters, and it's aggravating to the nth degree. Moving on to number three, the ending of this issue. Is it appropriate that I'm listing my last thing that I don't like with the ending of the issue itself also?
Well, if it's not appropriate, at least it's conveniently symmetrical. So yeah, the last thing I didn't like is the ending of the comic. Their way out of this issue, this storyline, is the oldest, lamest ending to any Doctor Who episode now, I think, that you could come up with as a Doctor Who story writer. They decided they were going to end this issue with total chronal collapse in big bold letter with exclamation points. Yes, time is collapsing into itself. Oh no! How unusual and horrifying. At least it looks really cool. They've, like, outlined everything, like, seven times in every color of the rainbow, and it's mind-meltingly cool to look at. But I felt really gypped. They should have been talking about the genocide or focusing on the overcast or keeping it specific to that little world that they have created that was new and interesting, but instead they fell back onto something old and boring, cheap, and lame. So that's my list. Oh, and in other news, the 11th Doctor again is missing from the 11th Doctor comic. This is the second issue in a row in which they've forgotten to include the 11th Doctor in their 11th Doctor comic. I'm not really sure how that happens, but it has. And frankly, I say that is unacceptable. Get it together, Titan Comics. All right. Thanks for listening. Have a great month. Bye, guys.
Okay, then, that wraps it up for the first edition of the Standalone TARDIS Library podcast. If you've tuned in and listened to our reviews, what did you think of the reviews? Are you reading the Titan comics? Do you read the NSAs? Just on the NSAs, I was really worried that there might not be a range of NSAs coming out this year, because there's certainly none scheduled for the rest of the year. And I thought, oh gosh, maybe these last few, you know, Big Bang Generation, Deep Time and so on, were the final books. Maybe people just don't buy these books in volume anymore. I've certainly heard stories about the Capaldi annuals not being bought in remaindered shops for, you know, 50p or 20p or some ridiculous price for months and months after they've come out. So is it all over for the NSAs? No, it's not. Justin Richards, the commissioning editor, I still believe, of the NSAs, at least he's got his finger in the pie somewhere along the line. I tweeted at him on Twitter, funnily enough, recently, and said, hey, are the NSAs all over? And he said, no, they'll be back when the new series is back. So I guess in the past, the NSAs have come out around this time of year because a new series of Doctor Who would be on television around this time of year. But because the new series isn't starting until April or whatever it is next year, I guess there'll be more NSAs, I assume three, being released around April of next year. And that's a really good thing. We'll definitely be reading them here in the TARDIS library, either myself or one of the team members, and we'll tell you all about them then. But that's many months away. We've got a lot of episodes to go before then. So until then, and until next episode, take care of yourselves. Do write in. Please let us know what you think of this standalone episode and all that good stuff. Hello at thedwshow.net. You know the drill by now. And I'll see you next time.